This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on August 6th, 2025.
Despite his busy schedule of pretending not to know Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump still finds time to be mad at TV. Today he posted, "Gayle King's career is over. She should have stayed with her belief in Trump. She never had the courage to do so. No talent, no ratings, no strength. Hey, Mr. President, back off. You are messing with my beloved CBS colleague and friend, Gayle King. And if you want to get to Gayle, you have to go through my show first." What's that? I'm sorry, hold on, what? Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, I didn't forget. Got your back, Stephen Colbert.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
As best we can.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internet around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Your mileage, of course, may vary. Glad to have you here with us today. I'm very much looking forward to being joined momentarily by Tim Carr of freepress.net. In the wake of Donald Trump's ongoing, arguably successful assault on our Constitution's freedom of the press clause and free speech clause, I was reminded of that when I heard Stephen Colbert there at the top of the show, after Trump and his party is pretty much cutting off all federal funding, has now cut off all federal funding to PBS and NPR, and after capitulations by a number of major corporate media outlets, like Stephen Colbert's Paramount-owned CBS that you heard there, capitulating to Trump's bullying and his use of the executive branch as a cudgel for them to do his bidding.
Yeah, you got to grab him by the free press, as it were.
I see what you did there. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
The nonprofit freepress.net is grabbing them. They have a new report on what they're calling their media capitulation index, naming names as far as which corporate media conglomerates are bending over the farthest to please Donald Trump, and a couple who, by the way, are decisively not doing so. And with that index, Tim has also published a new report titled A More Perfect Media, Saving America's Fourth Estate from Billionaires, Broligarchy, and Trump. We will talk about all of that momentarily, but first, local elections were held in a number of states on Tuesday this week, offering mostly good news for both Democrats and democracy, as I see it. Among a few contests of note in results that we have the day after in Detroit, in a 9-way so-called jungle primary, where the top two vote-getters, everyone of all parties runs together, the top two vote-getters go on to compete in the fall. Longtime city council member Mary Sheffield and megachurch leader Solomon Kinloch came out on top in Tuesday's 9-way primary to fill the seat being vacated by the popular 3-term mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan. He's running as an independent for Michigan's open governor's seat next year. But of note, the only Republican in that 9-way race on Tuesday in Detroit was former Detroit Police Chief James Craig. He had harshly responded to Black Lives Matter protests back in 2020. And despite being the only Republican in the race, where you'd think Democrats and independents would sort of, you know, split their votes around everyone else, with Republicans rallying around Craig, who frequently appears on Fox News, well, guess what? He came in fifth in the nine-way race in Detroit, winning just 5.2% of the vote on Tuesday. As of now, with late votes, of course, still being canvassed, Sheffield is the clear winner on Tuesday, winning almost 51% of the vote, and her November competitor, Kinloch, took just over 17%. Democrats defended a state house in a special election in Delaware in a very narrow race. As of last night, the margin was just 121 votes.
Wow.
With the Democrat, Alana Berry, being the apparent winner over Republican Nikki Miller. It is not the first time there has been such close election in this particular district. That margin of victory, as observed by Bolts Magazine's Daniel Nashanian, known as Daniel on the social medias, that margin on Tuesday of 50.7% to 49.3% was incredibly, reportedly, identical to the margin that the Democratic incumbent had won in that same district last November.
Wow.
Before resigning for health reasons. That's why the seat was open. This is a district that Kamala Harris won last year by 9 points, and yet this thing is a squeaker. So I suspect there will likely be a recount of some sort of that race. But given the fact that there were only, you know, just over 9,000 votes cast, you'd think it'd be an easy one to hand recount. But Delaware still uses touchscreen voting systems across the entire state that cannot be verified as reflecting any voter's vote accurately after an election. So there may not be all that much to count by hand, in fact, in that race. As Nashanian observes, Berry's victory brings Democrats back to a majority of 27 to 14 in the state house. Tuesday's race being the closest that the GOP has come this year to flipping any legislative district in the nation. Far better news for Democrats in Rhode Island in another special legislative election on Tuesday, with Democrats having defended a state Senate seat by a margin of, are you ready for this, 82% to 16%.
Well, I'm no math whiz, but that sounds pretty big.
Yeah, a 66-point win for the Democrats, for Stefano Famiglietti, who trounced Republican Alex Assermelli in the special election for Senate District 4 on Tuesday, called after the long-serving Senate president, who had held the seat since 1985, had died in office this past April. As Nashanian notes, Kamala Harris won that district by 11 points last year, but Famiglietti's win by 66 points represents, obviously, a huge overperformance for Democrats. In fact, the second largest one so far this year. In Seattle, Washington, progressives and Democrats so far appear to have done well in a couple of city council races. And Seattle's King County approved a $1.5 billion tax levy to maintain and expand the county's network of public parks. Well done, Seattle. Happily, I have not yet heard of any major problems for voters at the polls on Tuesday, though, as always, a reminder that sometimes problems at the polls or in the counting of votes do not become known until the days and weeks after the race. I'll try to keep an eye on especially that very close race in Delaware with the oddly similar results to last November for exactly that sort of a problem. Though with a touchscreen system, as I say, in Delaware, there's very little that can be done if problems are discovered after Election Day. Texas state Democratic lawmakers are still breaking quorum to avoid the Donald Trump, Governor Greg Abbott Republican scheme to rewrite the Lone Star State's U.S. House map in the middle of the decade, in hopes of stealing five otherwise blue seats in majority-minority areas, U.S. House district seats, in next year's midterms, with the state House Speaker in Texas, a Republican, threatening the courageous Democratic lawmakers with arrest, and with Governor Abbott attempting to use the court system to expel the Democratic House caucus leader for breaking quorum. All of that coming this week on the 60th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, which seems as if it might as well not exist anymore in the state of Texas. A whole other country, as they like to say down there. Anyway, more on all of that, hopefully on tomorrow's show, because I just want to mention this before we get to our guest today. So remember that pandemic that we all went through for a really long time just a few years ago?
Oh, definitely.
Is that ringing a bell? I know a lot of people have tried to forget it. But it was, you know, people across the globe were dying, you might recall, by the millions, including here in the U.S., which had one of the world's highest mortality rates under the failed leadership of, check my notes here. Oh, yeah, Donald Trump. The same guy who is now back in the White House, whose failed leadership, according to the chief of his own COVID-19 task force at the time, resulted in some 200,000 unnecessary deaths here in the U.S. At the time, up to 40% of the deaths from COVID were found to have been avoidable had we had adequate protective gear and had our leaders, like the president, encourage social distancing and the use of protective masks, which radically lowered the odds of catching the virus at a time when there were no vaccines to prevent it and no treatments if you caught it. Remember that? When 1.3 million Americans were killed by the virus and it overwhelmed hospitals and the healthcare system, when the nation was forced to largely stay at home for, I don't know, a year or two, when the stock market plummeted, millions lost their jobs, the global supply chain ground to a halt, inflation went through the roof, the fatality rate for those who caught the virus was about 6% at its peak in early spring of 2020. A far higher fatality rate than for the flu, which Donald Trump at the time compared it to, even as it reportedly almost killed him back when there was very limited testing, no vaccines at all, and hardly any treatment for those who were infected. Remember that? Well, at some point, all of those fatalities and that darkness began to fall away. The fatalities began to drop off. It took a few months and a few flare-ups as new variants raced against our ability to prevent it, but it has now almost disappeared entirely. I say almost because it is still there, but the fatality rate from a 6% high back in early 2020 is now about 0.3% now. I know a lot of people would like to forget about that period entirely. No one more so, I suspect, than the guy who is in the White House again. But yes, it actually did happen. And yes, the death rate eventually would plummet, not because the virus was, you know, just miraculously went away, as Trump had long promised, falsely promised that it would. It hasn't gone away. It's still around. But we ended up developing a revolutionary vaccine for the SARS COVID-19 virus, which ultimately radically reduced both the rate of infection and the rate of fatality for those who took the shot. It did not just go away. We helped send it away with that vaccine. It also helped those who did not take the vaccine shot because it meant that the virus was far less prevalent and far less deadly. Thanks to a miracle vaccine with a new technology called mRNA, developed in a record time frame, and by the way, that was thanks in no small part to Donald Trump, who, while he otherwise disastrously failed at virtually everything else revolving around the COVID pandemic, he did push for a huge investment in research for that vaccine, so credit where it's due. And thanks to that vaccine, the numbers in the U.S. and across the world began to turn around, and we eventually emerged from our long, dark years of COVID-19, the worst pandemic in 100 years. Just wanted to remind you about that, because I know a lot of us would like to forget it. Nonetheless, on Tuesday night this week, as reported by the New York Times, Donald Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has canceled nearly $500 million worth of grants and contracts for developing mRNA vaccines, the Department of HHS announced. It is the latest blow to research on this technology, this life-saving technology, this pandemic-ending technology. In May, the Department of Health and Human Services revoked a nearly $600 million contract to the drug maker Moderna to develop a vaccine against bird flu, because we'd hate to have that. The new cancellations have dismayed scientists, many of whom regard mRNA shots as the best option for protecting Americans in a pandemic. Quote, "This is a very bad day for science," said Scott Hensley, an immunologist at the University of Pennsylvania who's been working to develop an mRNA vaccine against the flu. The health department said in its release that the cancellations affected 22 projects managed by the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA. And with this move, the department is, quote, "undermining our ability to rapidly counter future biological threats," according to Rick Bright, a flu expert who was ousted as chief of BARDA during the first Trump administration. He added, quote, "We're weakening our frontline defense against fast-moving pathogens, a huge strategic failure that will be measured in lives lost during times of crisis." First used during the COVID-19 pandemic, the mRNA shots instruct the body to produce a fragment of a virus, which then sets off the body's immune response to it. Unlike traditional vaccines, which can take years to develop and to test, mRNA shots can be made within months and quickly changed as the virus changes. Nonetheless, Kennedy has been sharply critical of the technology for some reason. In a video posted on social media on Tuesday, the Secretary of the Health Department, who has no medical or scientific background whatsoever, claimed incorrectly that mRNA vaccines do not protect against respiratory illnesses like COVID and the flu, and that they drive viruses to evolve, and that a single mutation in a virus renders the vaccine completely ineffective, all of which is untrue. None of that is true, at least according to the worldwide scientific consensus, and I should note, the truth witnessed firsthand by about 8 billion people who live on this planet and saw what happened after these vaccines were actually developed and used. Quote, "By issuing this wildly incorrect statement," said Jennifer Nuzzo, the director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health, "the secretary is demonstrating his commitment to his long-held goal of sowing doubts about all vaccines. Had we not used these life-saving mRNA vaccines to protect against severe illness, we would have had millions of more COVID deaths," she said. The health department said it will favor other types of shots over those using groundbreaking mRNA technology like whole cell vaccines. That technology is more than 100 years old. The U.S. has not used a whole cell vaccine for whooping cough, for example, since the 1990s because it was potent, but it was harsh, and it often set off high fevers and seizures. Imagine if the mRNA vaccine had set off seizures. And yet, that's where Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary wants to go with vaccines right now. If you can make any more sense of all of this than me, feel free to drop me a note via bradcast@bradblog.com, because I got nothing. At least I don't have COVID, I guess, for now. Whether I'll be able to take another annual shot against it, and for the flu, critical for folks like myself, well, I guess that now remains to be seen, because Trump and RFK are busy making America healthy again, right? Or maybe just making America have seizures and die prematurely again. How much about all of that we will hear from the corporate media in the months ahead? Well, that may depend on how much their corporate owners are currently bending over for Donald Trump, as we'll discuss next with Timothy Carr of FreePress.net. That is straight ahead on today's independent broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. It may be infected with COVID.
Fox Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. That song, that bumper music will make some sense soon enough. We've spent no small amount of time on this program in recent weeks, though it is sadly never enough, discussing the acute assault against and capitulation by corporate mainstream media outlets in this country right now in the face of what I think is fair to say is an unprecedented attack against them by a president of the United States and a Republican Party that shamefully supports his direct assault on what the framers of this nation etched into our founding document in its very first amendment as the right to free speech and a free press. In fact, the founders saw the issue of a free press as so important toward protecting against the rise of a monarchy of the type that they were escaping in their newly created nation some 250 years ago, that the press became the only industry cited specifically in the Constitution, receiving explicit protections from the government. And yet, almost 250 years later, despite those protections still embedded in our founding documents, we find that an authoritarian leader has been able to breach those bedrock protections in order to strengthen and arguably protect his own authoritarian political agenda. That, of course, is exactly what the framers of the Constitution had tried so hard to protect against. As Tim Carr of FreePress.net argues in a new report on capitulation by mainstream media to the bullying of Donald Trump, quote, Thomas Jefferson famously argued that newspapers were more important to self-rule than government. But while he valued the role of a free press in a democratic society, notes Carr, he also acknowledged the potential for abuse and manipulation. He and other founders, however, came to believe that a free and yes, often unruly press was a necessary evil, a price to be paid for the benefits of an informed and engaged citizenry. But the protections sought and enacted in our founding document by the framers have, if not fallen, become wildly tenuous at best, it seems to me, in the Trump era, where bashing the media has become a signature Trumpism, Carr notes, with the president's attacks against the free press too routine and numerous to list. Trump has labeled legacy media, quote, the enemy of the people dozens of times, adding that the reporting of many outlets, quote, has to be illegal. Reporting by the very free press guaranteed in the very first amendment to the U.S. Constitution, quote, has to be illegal, according to the sitting president of the United States. Trump has sicked his obedient Federal Communications Commission chairman, Brendan Carr, on any media corporation that strays from the Trump line. Their crime in the eyes of the president and his minions is questioning the administration's far-right agenda, reporting accurately on its activities, or even supporting an idea or airing the views of anyone who stands in Trump's way, argues Tim Carr. As I argued a week or two ago, just after Congress, at Donald Trump's demand, finally rescinded the federal government's paltry funding of PBS and NPR, a meager $1.1 billion per year, amounting to about $1.60 per year for every American, in exchange for hundreds of public-oriented and non-commercial television stations and thousands of critical radio stations in large cities and rural towns alike across the nation. While the threat posed by Republicans to our nation's news and media outlets has been ongoing and persistent for years, a very real takeover of media systems by an autocratic wannabe dictator is right now underway in these United States. The defunding of NPR and PBS, long sought and threatened by Republicans for decades but finally realized last month, coincided with CBS News owner Paramount settling a ridiculous defamation lawsuit against them and their landmark 60 Minutes program by Donald Trump, as Paramount found itself needing approval of Trump's FCC chair, Brendan Carr, for a corporate mega-merger with a company named Skydance. That followed a similar capitulation by ABC News owner, the Walt Disney Corporation, on the heels of a separate but similarly ridiculous lawsuit filed against them by Donald Trump for defamation. Another frivolous lawsuit that most legal experts agree, like the one against 60 Minutes, would have been laughed out of court if it had ever gotten there. But Disney also capitulated for $16 million to Donald Trump. Neither case made it to court. In both cases, the major conglomerates who own and control the news outlets folded to Trump's pressure in hopes of staying in his good graces, apparently, to receive his blessing for their other business interests moving forward. CBS, just days later, as you know, announced the cancellation of Trump critic Stephen Colbert's top-rated late-night comedy show at a moment that was impossible to distinguish from Paramount CBS's capitulation in that dumb lawsuit just days earlier. And it's not only outlets that the right has long disingenuously characterized as so-called liberal or left-wing, with successes in taking down NPR, PBS, ABC, CBS under his belt, Trump is even moving against right-leaning media, like the Rupert Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal, who Trump sued just over a week ago for $10 billion because they dared to report, apparently accurately, on a fawning birthday card that the adjudicated sexual assaulter and felon Donald Trump had reportedly sent to his adjudicated sexual assaulter and longtime felon best friend, Jeffrey Epstein. As I noted a week or two ago, this is not a warning about what may be coming. It is a notification about what is already here. Trump is successfully undermining our nation's theoretically constitutionally protected free press, outlet by outlet and piece by piece, from top to bottom and left to right. And the situation is likely to get far worse before it gets better. Last week, on the heels of the federal defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps fund NPR and PBS, the co-CEO of FreePress.net's Action Fund, Craig Aaron, described the news as, quote, devastating for this country, noting, quote, this is about far more than one government agency or the embarrassingly low public investment the United States makes in public media compared to the rest of the world. The elimination of funding for public media is about trying to end accountability, pump out propaganda, and sow the kind of chaos and disinformation under which authoritarianism thrives. His statement, critical of the defunding of public media, followed just days after a newly released Media Capitulation Index published by FreePress.net, and a detailed report on the state of the media to go with it, titled A More Perfect Media, Saving America's Fourth Estate from Billionaires, Broligarchy, and Trump. That report was written by Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at the nonprofit FreePress.net, which, by the way, was co-founded in 2003 by our good friend, progressive journalist John Nichols. And I'm happy to say that Timothy Carr joins me now to discuss all of this. Tim Carr, thank you for joining us today on the Still Independent Bradcast, sir.
Yes, and thank goodness for that. Happy to be here with you, Brad. That was a great lead-in. And if we can geek out a little bit on history there, because I like that you brought in the founders. Uh-huh. I mean, it was the lawmakers ratified the Bill of Rights in December 1791, of which, of course, contains the First Amendment. But they also, a couple of months later, passed the Postal Services Act. Mm-hmm. February 1792, that's George Washington signed that into law. So they, our founders not only saw a prohibitive role of government, right, not to interfere with the free press, but they also proactively created a subsidy. The Postal Service Act subsidized the distribution of newspapers and journals across the young nation. So government, you know, there are two purposes. One is to keep your hands off a free press, but another is to see media and news and information as a public good that the government should support, which is interesting given what's just happened to the CPB, right? We've taken away that $1.1 billion. It was already in the budget, but a Trump, what's called a rescission request, clawed it back, and CPB has shuttered or will shutter its offices later this year.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, in your report, which I thought was great, by the way, I'll link to it, of course, in full when I post today's show. It focuses largely on the alarming commercial media capitulation that we've seen in the 6 months since Trump has taken office. But yeah, on the for a moment on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Do you see this move as one that is likely to stick beyond the Trump administration, or is this the sort of a bump in the road at this point for American public media as you see it?
I mean, it's really hard to build back things once they're taken away. The only hopeful signs that we have is that the American public in poll after poll has said that public funding for PBS and NPR and local public radio and television stations is money well spent. I think there was a poll that said it ranked second only to spending on the military as, you know, a good use of taxpayer funds. And so there is a groundswell of public support for public media. And I think one of the challenges of organizations like ours is after, you know, Trump is gone, or even before, if Democrats regain control of Congress, there will be public headwinds or public, I mean, public winds blowing in the right direction for restoring that money. But I think it's also, and it's something that, you know, we've been involved in this fight for years. It's not just a question of restoring the money that was there. As you mentioned in your lead-in, you know, it amounts to about $1.60 per person in the United States, which by comparison to healthy democracies around the world is a paltry sum.
Right.
But it's also, and maybe, you know, if there is this sort of pendulum effect, let's imagine a post-Trump world where we're trying to, you know, there is public momentum for fixing all of these wrongs. If there is a pendulum swing, we can build back better, right? Build back a public media system that is more robust and actually get support not only to your local NPR and PBS station, though a lot of people love those, but also to a lot of these really smaller, independent, non-commercial online news and information ventures that are sprouting up in locations around the country.
You know, one thing that I've sort of been scratching my head about as I've been watching them, you know, take away the funding from NPR and PBS, is that Trump has explicitly said that the reason for defunding them is because they are leftist, liberal, quote, monstrosities, as he described them. Not because the U.S. can't afford it or the money is better spent elsewhere for whatever reason, but because of what he, at least, sees as their ideology, their left-wing ideology as he sees it. Now, if that doesn't explicitly, I mean, he's saying it out loud, if that doesn't explicitly violate the First Amendment, I really don't know what does, but then the question is, Tim Carr, who enforces the First Amendment when it is so blatantly violated as in a case such as this? Anyone?
Well, I mean, it's up to the courts, right? The courts determine whether any sort of action brought before them is a violation of press freedom as defined by the First Amendment.
Are you aware of anybody bringing a case to refund PBS and NPR based on that? Because, I mean, he's out and out saying, oh, it's because they're leftists. Let's take away their funding. I mean,
well,
I believe,
and I'm going to have to check this, but I'm pretty sure that NPR has brought a case. I know there also is also been a part of this effort has been to defund Voice of America, which is international. It's called public diplomacy. And Voice of America was created in the wake of World War II and the onset of the Cold War, mm-hmm. to create this American voice around the world that promoted democracy and capitalism. And you know, it's been called by some propaganda, but the voice of America of recent times is actually pretty good. I mean, it's independent. Reporting in the news in multiple languages around the world. I lived in Vietnam for 5 years in the 1990s. I was a reporter there. Mm-hmm. And the number of young Vietnamese kids who listened to Voice of America and actually learned English from Voice of America was impressive. And so it's also been defunded. And so I mean, there's a lot going on. I think VOA has brought a case, as elements of VOA are also looking at their legal options. So there is a vehicle, right, through the courts. I mean, there are questions about if this goes all the way to the Supreme Court, you know, which there are some legitimate questions about recent rulings of that court, you know, whether they side with Trump on this or not. I think it's a real concern.
Yeah, I mean, and at the same time, and loss of Voice of America is a tremendous loss. We've been covering that quite a bit on this show. It's a tremendous loss to the nation and the world. But, you know, when you look at these cases, time and again, you know, Trump says the reason they should be defunded is because they're, you know, liberal left wing, even if they are, which I don't believe they necessarily are, but even if they are, we have a free press. And to use the government to defund them on that basis seems to me a clear-cut case. If we had a legitimate Supreme Court, that would be stopped. And I want to get to your media capitulation report in a second, focusing on, again, commercial media outlets. But when it comes to NPR and PBS, with their funding on the line, by the way, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been run for the last 20 years by the CEO, the president of CPB, is a Republican Party operative who was appointed by George W. Bush back in 2005. You know, so there's your leftist organization. But did NPR and PBS, with their funding on the line, did they capitulate in any way to please or try to placate Donald Trump, as many of these commercial outlets you have found that we're about to discuss have been doing?
Well, I mean, I think that they have been very careful, knowing this threat existed. I don't know if that filtered down into the newsroom. And when I created the Media Capitulation Index, we started it, you know, right after the Trump election, when we saw prominent media owners like Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, you know, releasing congratulatory statements, flying to Mar-a-Lago to dine with the incoming president. You know, we're really focused on the commercial side. Mm-hmm. We looked at the 35 largest commercial media enterprises to see if there was a pattern, right? People had heard about, of course, Bezos has changed the Washington Post to be in alignment with his friend, Donald Trump. He told an interviewer after the election that he was super optimistic about the Trump administration and planned to help him. And it seems like Bezos' gesture involved, you know, tamping down editorial cartoons, op-eds in the Washington Post. So, I mean, so we looked at the commercial, we looked at these billionaire owners, and we looked at the 35 largest media companies in the commercial side. We didn't look at the non-commercial side, PBS mm-hmm. and NPR, but I think, you know, it's worth considering that. As well, to see whether there was an impact on their editorial coverage in the last 6 months.
Well, let's talk about that new report. It's titled "A More Perfect Media: Saving America's Fourth Estate from Billionaires, Broligarchy, and Trump." So it both analyzes how, in your words, too many massive media companies are failing to hold power to account and defend our democracy in the face of persistent threats from the Trump administration. Now, the report highlights capitulation of those 35 outlets that you mentioned on a scale from 1 to 5 chickens, which I think is hilarious. And you reserve a star rating for outlets that remain independent from Trump's media assaults. Well, first, before we get into how many chickens and stars were found on the list, explain that rating system to me, the 1 through 5 system you've got here.
Well, I mean, there's a long version and the short version. I'll give you the short version. Well, obviously chickens are seen as a symbol of cowardice, right? People chicken out. Mm-hmm. And I got nothing against chickens individually, but we had, we were trying to figure out, like, if we were to do a rating system that involved a symbol, what would that symbol be? And one of the things that we discovered is that it's good to use emojis, because emojis can translate into text. Uh-huh. They can relates into social media. It doesn't matter what type of platform you're using. Most all of them accept emojis. So I went to a place called Emojipedia. Uh-huh. That is the entire universe of emojis that are available out there. And I searched and I found the chickens. And I thought, well, that's will probably work. So then we align them. Five chickens in this rating system is propaganda. And we gave Truth Social 5 chickens, because it is owned by President Trump, yeah, the social company. He uses it to issue statements. And so it is pure propaganda. And then we went all the way back to 1 chicken, which was vulnerable. For example, we gave the New York Times 1 chicken because of its tendency to normalize the most excessive actions of the Trump administration. It is mostly found in the New York Times headlines. And a lot of people are debating that to this day. I mean, mm-hmm. when we came up with the 1 chicken rating for the New York Times, a lot of folks thought it should be more chickens. And right. So this is a debate ongoing. And we plan to keep the index going and do a regular release that updates these ratings. And it hopefully, it will incentivize these companies to do better. In fact, I got a call, I won't mention his name, or rather it was an email from the chair of one of these large media companies who was concerned about his company's rating. And so they're clearly paying attention.
How many chickens did that company get?
It only had 1.
And yet he was still worried about the rating. Good.
I'll say one thing. It was a company that published The Art of the Deal, which of course is pure fiction, the Trump biography that was ghostwritten, that the company who published it acknowledged that there wasn't a lot of truth in Trump's biography, and yet they published it anyway. So that earned them a chicken.
I was surprised how many chickens were actually in these ratings, Tim. As I said, 2 of the 35 conglomerates you looked at did receive an independent star rating, which you broke down the report into categories: broadcasting and entertainment, online platforms and streaming, cable and telecom, and newspapers and publishing. And almost all of them, all but 2 that you looked at, had from 1 to 5 chickens. My first question on this is, why? Are these outlets capitulating to Trump because huge corporations are generally right-leaning by nature? Is it because they're run by folks who are actually sympathetic to Trump's politics and his agenda? Or is it, as the chickens might suggest, simply because they are afraid of what Trump could do to their business concerns if they do not roll over to him?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that question, but I think the main reason why, and this is one of the main findings in the report, is that these companies have become too big not to fail. That is, they are sprawling media conglomerates. They're not just media conglomerates. They have interests in other businesses. If you look at Jeff Bezos and Amazon, he also owns Blue Origin, which is a space exploration company that is looking for billions of dollars in federal contracts. A lot of the tech companies are looking for federal contracts for AI. And so when you get larger and you have all of these conflicts of interest, all of these entanglements with government, the tendency is to tread lightly. And that is exactly not what we want our media to do. So it's interesting. Like, conversely, I haven't done the full analysis, but if we were to include smaller, independent, local news operations, things like ProPublica, for example, non-commercial, I think you would see a lot more stars in this. But we were really looking at the 35 largest conglomerates, and these conglomerates have interests, you know, business interests across the whole landscape. And another reason that they would be capitulating are companies, for example, like Verizon. Verizon wanted to get government approval of its merger with Frontier Communications, telecommunications companies. Mm-hmm. And that approval did not come through until Verizon agreed to scrub its diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And they Chairman Carr at the FCC celebrated that capitulation on DEI as one of the reasons that they won this merger approval.
Now, Donald Trump is obviously a unique case. I mean, even Richard Nixon, who notoriously hated the press, he had an enemies list for it, etc. You know, Nixon didn't go after media interests as directly as Donald Trump has. But how unusual is it for these huge corporate concerns to try and curry favor with presidents? I feel like we saw some of this during the George W. Bush years, if not to this extent. But couldn't we always find examples of, you know, even during Democratic presidencies, of at least some of this, given the way the media has, you know, been merged into just a handful of companies who seem like they all have other business that is before the government?
Sure. Now, it's not unusual for large corporations to bend to the prevailing political winds in Washington. I mean, every 4 years, you'll see their government relations offices in D.C. routinely staff up on lobbyists with close ties to the new party in power. Mm-hmm. But this is something of a different order, right? Wealthy media companies were aligning themselves with an authoritarian-minded leader who had little regard for the First Amendment, that he swore on the Bible to uphold and defend on January 20th. So this is capitulation of a different order. It's not a bending to the prevailing political winds, but it's a complete caving to an authoritarian and abdicating their responsibility, protected under the First Amendment, to act as a check against abuses of power, to speak truth to power. And, you know, as we saw with Paramount, as we saw with Disney through CBS and ABC, that has pretty dangerous consequences for democracy.
Before we get to discussing in the few minutes we have left what to do about all of this, how to find our way out of this mess, if that is even possible, I did note that there were two media conglomerates among the 35 that you looked at who actually earned a star, not a chicken, but a single star, indicating independence. It seems like we should give credit where that's due. Who are they, and how did they manage, at least for now, to avoid capitulation, Tim?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the two were Bloomberg News Service, mm-hmm. and Netflix, which is both of which are also owned by billionaires. Michael Bloomberg is not a friend of President Trump's, and he's been very outspoken opponent of Trump and Trumpism. And the other piece with Bloomberg, and I think this is also true to some extent with the Wall Street Journal, which is facing pressure from Trump right now, is that the Bloomberg brand is built on accuracy. You cannot sell a business information service if the business community doesn't trust that you're being objective and accurate. And I've worked with Bloomberg reporters. I mean, they will go to a press conference that a company gives, and they aren't even allowed to accept a drink. They have to, like, they can't accept any gifts. They're only allowed to drink a glass of water. And so they prize their independence because of their business relies on it. And with Netflix, Reed Hastings, who is the CEO there, he's a pretty progressive person, and he's doubled down on protecting the company's approach to diversity, equity, and inclusion in the face of, you know, Trump issued an executive order against DEI, and Netflix has responded saying, you know, diversity is what makes our company successful. So they deserve credit for that. And as I said earlier, and if we were looking at a lot of smaller media companies. I mean, I think size is really the determining factor here. There would be a lot more stars.
Size matters. I get it, Tim. Now, your report, actually, I could talk to you about this all day, because where have we, the people, failed, given that the founders, the only institution they mention is in the Constitution is the free press, and yet it seems like it has slipped away in so many ways. But I want to get to some solutions. Your report, you cite the words of the late, great Bill Moyers from an address that he made at a free press conference with thousands of media and democracy advocates in attendance back in 2008, I think. He said, quote, "Our dominant media are ultimately accountable only to corporate boards whose mission is not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for the whole body of our republic, but for the aggrandizement of corporate executives and shareholders." Before he went on to say, "But nothing is ever broken that can't be fixed if enough people are committed." The question, of course, is how committed are we to fixing this? And then if we do decide we want to, how do we do it? You argue in a more perfect media quote, "Now is not the time for backsliding. To ensure democracy survives the present moment, we need to organize behind a popular movement to fix everything that Trump has broken. Near the top of that list should be repairs to a media system that has allowed far too much control over information to fall into the hands of far too few." You include 4 policy recommendations to do just that. Can you quickly walk us through those?
Sure. So one of them, in which we've already talked about this, is the fully fund public media and independent local accountability journalism. I mean, it is one thing to restore the CPB, but we need to even do more. And we talked a little bit about that at the top. Another is to restore and strengthen media ownership limits. The Congress has put in place media ownership limits. The Federal Communications Commission's job is to enforce those and promote diversity and localism and competition, but it has really fallen down on the job on that. The other is to embolden the FCC and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, role in stopping media mergers that harm the public interest. I mean, oftentimes they bless mergers that lead to layoffs and lead to fewer journalists on the job. And the last one was to reestablish federal agency independence. We have now at the FTC and the FCC two chairmen who are handmaidens to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And they will do anything and everything, even, with some things that are questionable on a constitutional basis, to fulfill Trump's demands and push his political agenda.
And I want to just jump in to say on that first point that we've touched on a couple of times, fully fund public media and independent local accountability journalism. We're seeing more and more independent media outlets, like the Texas Tribune, Cal Matters, nonprofit media outlets that I think are becoming more and more critical in this corporate age. And I just want to encourage folks to support groups, organizations like that, and that nonprofit model for news that I think is going to be key moving forward. But Tim, a lot of these points that you just mentioned, frankly, are points that folks like you and I have been talking about for years and years. Kind of nothing new under the sun, when it comes to the FCC doing its job, when it comes to the idea of funding public media, media ownership limits, and so forth. And yet we seem to continue to be moving in the wrong direction. Do you see a tipping point somehow in the days ahead that may reverse that finally? Are Americans waking up to what is actually going on and to the alarms that folks like me are trying to ring, saying this is not, a threat, this is here? Do you see a tipping point ahead?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And really, that's the central mission of Free Press, is to engage the public in these often complex, often arcane, often wonky policy debates. And we've found that people are really engaged. We've got millions and millions of people to comment at the FCC in support of net neutrality, which is a again, another wonky issue that people seem to mobilize behind. But there is also a hopeful sign. There is a lot of work being done at the state level right now. Free Press has been very involved in getting state funding for very local media in New Jersey. We're working in places like California and Oregon and Massachusetts, where there are state-level legislators who understand the problem in the same way that you and I do and are willing to do things. There's an interesting a piece of legislation that is going to be proposed in Pennsylvania that gets at a lot of these problems as well. Mm. So I would say that's where the hopeful sign is for now. And that's realistically, given the political climate in Washington, where we need to focus a lot of our efforts. And I think from those models and from the successes at the state level, we can then go back to make the federal case for restoring funding for public media and really reforming the FCC and the FTC in ways that will make them better advocates of the public interest.
Nice to hear. Good to know. And the idea that the fight is still continuing in perhaps a more direct way at the state level. That is good to know. On that encouraging news, let me get out before things get bad again. Tim Carr, your work at freepress.net and the work that y'all have been doing there for more than 20 years now is obviously more critical and important than ever. Thank you for it. I will link folks to both of your new reports when I post today's show at bradblog.com. You can find Tim Carr on the Blue Skies at Tim Carr. That's K-A-R-R. That's the way the good cars spell it, I understand. And, of course, you can find their reports at freepress.net, but I will link to that. And by the way, when you find Tim over on Blue Sky, his profile reads, "A crash scene investigation at the crossroads of new media and public policy." Sounds about right. Tim Carr, thanks for joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Brad.
You bet. Okay, we got to get out. We are running late as usual. Thanks again, Tim. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. We are able to make that available to you thanks to those of you who support this independent media outlet by hitting a donate button or going straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves as long as we possibly can. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you'll find me, especially at Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.